Our Children Kill by Tom Sanders and the Anderson Valley Advertiser. The trainee was forced to watch the films by having his head bolted in a clamp so that he could not turn away, and a special device to keep him from closing his eyes. The U.S. government denies Commander Narut's claims, but Watson wrote that he had communicated with the person who had provided Narut with his violent films, and the London Times published an article about Narut's use of the violent films. Next came conditioning techniques to develop an automatic firing behavior in the soldier. There is no more lying prone on the ground shooting at a bullseye target. The trainee stands in a foxhole, weapon at ready, and fires at man-shaped targets as they suddenly pop up briefly in his line of fire. If the target is hit, it immediately drops. Enough hits result in receiving marksmanship badges, 3-day passes, and other perks. This special training conditions the troops to fire at living targets as well, without thinking, and has done much to increase the firing weight of American soldiers since World War II. In Vietnam, it took an average of 50,000 rounds of ammunition to kill one Viet Cong soldier. Many probably weren't soldiers. But the U.S. Army and U.S. Marine snipers in Vietnam, who had gone through the new advanced special training against lifelike targets, fired only 1.39 rounds to kill. And of course, police, like the military, no longer fire at bullseyes. They also use man-shaped targets. Older men are often able to resist these new special conditioning techniques, realizing when they are in combat that their so-called enemy are human beings just like them, while teenage boys are almost never able to resist this type of conditioning. This fact has long been known to the world's professional soldiers and is one of the main reasons the armies of the world want to recruit 17, 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. If most of us were horrified to find out about these training techniques and their results used on our teenage armed forces members, then why do we permit the same process to occur to millions of our children, many of whom are not yet in their teens? It begins with TV cartoons depicting violence and then proceeds to countless thousands of acts of violence shown on TV movies as the child grows up, with the network competition for ratings steadily raising the threshold of TV violence. Then when children reach a certain age, they are allowed to watch movies in theaters with enough violence to receive a PG-13 rating due to brief scenes of spurting blood from bullet wounds or chopped off limbs. Then within about a year, most parents permit their children to watch movies rated R because of even more spurting blood, bullets exploding out the back of human bodies and showers of blood, brains, etc. Finally, at the age of 17, children can legally watch R-rated movies, and at the age of 18, they can watch movies rated worse than R. These movies somehow show eyes being gouged out, along with parts of the brain, as some military and police special forces are trained to do. Thus, at the malleable age of the late teens, the ages at which armies have long traditionally begun to indoctrinate their soldiers into the specialty of killing, our children are, in their own towns and homes, receiving an inhuman form of military training in how to kill people. Many have become obsessed with violence and love such movies as Friday the 13th, Halloween, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Silence of the Lambs, and the Rambo series, watching them again and again on video. Movie characters like Hannibal the Cannibal, Jason, and Freddy Krueger are sick, unquestionably evil, and criminally sociopathic. They have nothing in common with the exotic and misunderstood Frankenstein monster and Wolfman villains of an earlier generation. The horror movies today are very well made in lifelike color, as well as being terribly violent, and in the theaters provide the usually adolescent viewers with candy, soft drinks, group companionship, and the intimate physical contact of a boyfriend or girlfriend. Thus, these watchers learn to associate these rewards with what they are watching. Powerful group processes often work to humiliate and belittle viewers who avert their gaze during the most gruesome scenes. Thus, many of them have had their heads bolted in a psychological clamp so they cannot turn away, and social pressure keeps their eyelids open. B.F. Skinner, who conducted experiments in operant conditioning, rejected the Freudian and humanist theories of personality development and held that all behavior is a result of past rewards and punishment. To Skinner, the child is a blank slate who can be turned into anything provided sufficient control of the child's environment is instituted at an early enough age. That is why, if Skinner is correct, and he seems to be, all the media, not just TV movies, are so important in developing children. I have visited them and seen children of almost all ages standing behind plastic machine guns and other weapons shooting electronic lifelike human targets that pop up on the video screen. They carefully look down the sights, already learning to aim and shoot properly. Then, when they squeeze the trigger, the weapon vibrates realistically, shots ring out, and if they hit the enemy, it drops to the ground, often with limbs or chunks of flesh flying in the air. The important distinction between the killing-enabling process that occurs in the video arcades and that of the military is that the military's is focused on the enemy soldier, with particular emphasis on ensuring the soldier acts only under military authority. Yet the video games that our children conduct their combat training with have no real sanction for firing on the wrong target. There is no drill sergeant present in the arcade to supervise our children in their learning to kill as there is in the military. And while the drill sergeant has a profound one-time impact and is often a role model for the young soldier, the aggregate effect of a lifetime of movies, TV, comic books, etc. may very well be even greater than that of the drill sergeant. It is really not new to point out that television executives here for years claimed that they are not capable of influencing our actions or changing behavior. But for decades, America's major corporations have paid them billions of dollars for a paltry few seconds or a minute to do just that. To sponsors, media executives claim that just a few well-placed seconds can control how America will spend its hard-earned money. But to Congress and other watchdog agencies, they argue that they are not responsible for causing viewers to change the way they will respond to any emotionally charged, potentially violent circumstance that they may subsequently find themselves in. This is in spite of the fact that as of 1994, there have been more than 200 studies demonstrating the correlation between television and violence. It has long been known by the general public that movies can have a negative effect on society through their role modeling process and general simplification of an often complicated issue. For example, the 1917 movie Birth of a Nation, which was premiered first in the White House for Virginia-born and raised President Woodrow Wilson, has been widely credited with the revival of the Ku Klux Klan several years later in the 20s. I remember when Birth of a Nation was shown again in 1950 in Lubbock, Texas. Several large crosses were burned the following nights in various places throughout the city, other than just in the African-American community. Movies made prior to the U.S.'s deep involvement in the Vietnam morass portrayed killing only under the authority of law. If not, killers were punished. The villain never got away with his violence and had always received justice in some way for his crimes. The message was simple. No man is above the law. Crime does not pay, and for violence to be acceptable, it must be guided by the constraints of the law. The hero is rewarded for obeying the law and channeling his desire for vengeance through the authority of the law. The viewer identified with the hero and was vicariously reinforced whenever the hero was, and the audience members left the theater feeling good about themselves and sensing the existence of a just, lawful world. But today there is a new kind of hero in movies, a hero who operates outside the law. Vengeance is a much older, darker, more atavistic, and more primitive concept than law, and these new anti-heroes are being depicted as being motivated and rewarded for their obedience to the goals of vengeance rather than those of law, or I might say, than those of justice. And if America has a police force that seems unable to constrain its violence, and a population that, having seen the videotape of Rodney King and the LAPD, has learned to fear its police force, then the reason can be found in the entertainment industry. Is more gun control the answer? Is the best way to put out a fire in a house to pour water on it while someone else is continuing to pour gasoline on it? More gun control will not affect the minds of our children. The history of this country shows that guns have always been available to almost any child who wanted one. The difference is that before TV and movies began to glorify violence, thanks to the urging of the military-industrial complex corporations who have been making a fortune off our militarized economy and the military itself, children did not want to kill anything with guns. Even on farms and ranches in droughts, when rabbits were eating what little grass there was for cattle, my older cousins and I had to be encouraged and pushed over a period of time before we were able to shoot jackrabbits, even when we saw how they were destroying the crops and range grass at the expense of the starving cattle. The basic cause of our children killing people is the militarization of our entire society that has been going on beneath our noses for so-called anti-communist and patriotic reasons since 1941. All of our wars and police actions since the Vietnam War have been prepared pushovers so we could try out our newest weapons. Grenada, Panama, Iraq, and now Yugoslavia have been child's play with virtually no loss of American life or equipment except for the thousands of American boys who have been poisoned by the toxic depleted uranium projectiles used in Iraq, and I might add in Yugoslavia, and of course the poisoning there was of the Yugoslavian people. Yet the president at the time and the commanding generals and admirals were portrayed in the media as heroes. When is it heroic to take candy from a baby? When is it heroic to defeat a small nation, no matter how terrible its leaders may be, when the nation is practically defenseless and we cause great loss of civilian life and property? General violence and mass murder has become the unwritten law of the land, not only in the country itself, but in those parts of the world that U.S. capitalism is trying to conquer for its markets and control. We citizens must accept the fact that the United States has become a worldwide empire that dwarfs all others that ever existed. We must refuse to continue to accept the militarized society that has been covertly forced upon us. We must oppose the political party, one big property party in two sections, in friendly competition for show and entertainment that has long been in government power. It is long overdue for us to begin discussions for a nationwide, people's-owned cooperative society so we can overturn the tinsel-covered carts pulled by dinosaurs in which our rulers and owners are riding. No more military killing training for our children. And this is a story, Why Our Children Kill, the Stealth Militarization of American Society, by Tom Sanders in the Anderson Valley Advertiser, and that's August 11th. If you want to get a copy of that, or you want to see the paper in which it appears, you can check out the Book Loft, which is at Soquel and Seabright, in case you happen to be in that neck of the woods, because that's where it's sold. Well, along those lines, not that I want to sound depressing, but here's an old song about an old killing that's kind of close to home.
Happy John Dine was a friend of mine, lived here by the sea. Down on the streets of Santa Cruz, he always laughed at me. Happy and I went to church one night, thank God, and ate our fill. Asked him if he had any money, give me a fake dollar bill. Where is Happy? He's gone away. And it's hard for me to be happy, Happy's in a grave. Oh, where is Happy? Shot down today. And I guess the police are happy, sadness is here to stay. Happy was as harmless as a butterfly, loved everyone he met. He never left the 60s, didn't really care for the internet. One day he was grooving to some tunes and doing the happy bop, when a bullet entered his chest, came from a Santa Cruz cop. Where is Happy? Shot down today. And it's hard for me to be happy, Happy's in a grave. Oh, where is Happy? He's gone away. And I guess the police are happy, sadness is here to stay. Now people like Happy, I do believe, heaven is great, great spirits. You know, like whatever you got here, less of, you got more there. Could happen. So I think he's up there, I think he's looking down, and he's probably saying, hey man, right on, I know you, power to the people. Where is Happy? He's gone away. And it's hard for me to be happy, Happy's in a grave. Where is Happy? Shot down today. And I guess the police are happy, sadness is here to say. Yeah, I guess the police are happy, sadness is here to stay.
And that was the ballad of Happy John Dine, the man killed by Officer Connor Carey in the Santa Cruz Police Department in a shooting whose independent investigation was quashed by our very own Citizens Police Review Board, led by Bill Christie, and still on the board, Lisa Rose. Give her a call, tell her, time to resign now. Good idea, off the Citizens Police Review Board. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and we're interested in seeing some justice for poor people, even those who've been shot by the police, and those who haven't. In fact, those who haven't perhaps need it even more at this time, because They're still alive, and Happy John Dine is dead. Actually, what's happening at the very moment that you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz and this show, Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides, I'm your host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert Norse, is on Club Cruz, our local community television station, tonight at 7 o'clock. There's an interview with David Silva on the Hate Crime Initiative. That's on Channel 71, Community Television of the Santa Cruz County. And David is, of course, gotten rather famous with his Hate Crime Initiative. I've always thought it was kind of lots of fluff and sound and fury signifying not too much. But I like the idea of talking about hate crimes in terms of, well, let's say homeless people, people who get beaten up by others that, we call them troll busters, because homeless people are called trolls by these people. Those kind of gnarled, ugly kind of folks you see under bridges. You can beat them up, can't you? That's not really a problem. I mean, they're not, you don't have to worry about that. Troll busters, the beating of innocent homeless people who sleep outside. 500 to 1,500 homeless people sleep outside in Santa Cruz each night. And it's illegal for every single one of them except for 25, 30 of them who get to get into the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program and sleep on the floors of churches. That's not many, and one would think that if you aren't going to give these folks a place to sleep, at least don't arrest them if they fall asleep in a vehicle or crawl under a bush. But no, that's not what Mayor Byers says, and that's not what her March 23rd law says. Her law says you fall asleep after 11 o'clock at night, you get a $54 ticket. You don't pay it, a warrant goes out for your arrest. You'll get jailed, but not really long enough to get much sleep, because often they let you out in the middle of the night. Without a blanket, without too much clothing, generally, because you get arrested at the height of the day. And if you're driving a car, well, then they'll confiscate your vehicle. And then you'll have to get that one out, too. And that's another fine to pay. And that's the fine for what? Some kind of violent acts against other people? Blowing up a building? No, that's the fine for falling asleep, because you are a poor person. A poor person in Santa Cruz. And that is something that I'm hoping we can see change. I'm hoping we can see change. And I don't know the road to change it. I know that a lot of people think it should be changed, that more people are coming to understand that a law against sleeping is a preposterous and unjust law. And that no matter how nervous merchants may be about everybody coming to town and sleeping in their neighborhood, and no matter how nervous neighbors may be about their children being at risk from homeless people, when in fact most violence against children happens among people in their own homes. That's where most murders happen. That's where most of the violence is domestic violence. It's not the one person you know that's going to get you, that you don't know. It's the person that you know that is going to beat you up, particularly if you're a woman. But in any case, there's a group now called the Homeless Issues Task Force. I've called it the Task Farce, because instead of making real changes, our city council kind of threw a bone to the most liberal member, Christopher Crone, and his colleague, Keith Sugar, who's our vice mayor, the only two people to vote for any real change in the sleeping ban ordinance, and said, well, here's a little commission for you, and here's $10,000. Set them to work on figuring out what to do. Well, we all know what to do. You have to guarantee civil rights for people. You have to provide adequate services, and you have to act immediately. Instead, of course, they were saying, we don't want to do it, so let's pretend we're doing something. So here's a little task force that can talk about it. Well, this task force met on Wednesday evening at 5:30, and they had their first meeting. It's supposed to be a task force of 12 people, the mayor, this nice-looking little old lady. She's probably not too much older than I am, but I guess most folks would regard her as a little old lady. Catherine Byers, I call her Buckshot Byers. My producer is in the studio, and she's having a hard time containing herself. I have to keep her in leash here. This is the mayor kind of overseed the opening of this homeless issues task force, and then kind of gave it over to the folks to do their thing. And what was this homeless issues task force? Well, we'll have to see. Sometimes the tame dog, even the tame dog, turns on the cruel owner and starts to bite back. Sometimes the people have had enough and they stand up and insist on their rights, even when they have been paid to sit down quietly and smile. So this task force may prove a little more difficult to control, than was originally thought at first. It's hard to tell. I maintain my skepticism. I have no interest in joining it myself, but I did attend it, and I'm going to play you some selections from the task force. A lot of good ideas came out of the task force. We don't need ideas, you know. We need action. And it's real hard to get together the groups of people to undertake the action that's necessary to make the change in our town that will protect not just homeless people from getting beaten up by troll busters, and there have been more than 20 such assaults since the beginning of the year, some as recently as a week and a half ago. We need to protect people against vicious, depredatory landlords who are raising their rents at a skyrocketing value away. At huge amounts of money are now required as the university's kind of mega corporation expands to cram more and more students into the university, which of course takes up all the housing, and Silicon Valley overpours, and the yuppies come our way to take the expensive housing and dump the rest of us, God knows where, on the streets, pretty much. In a way, it's a struggle that concerns all of us. It's not the homeless over here and the low-rent people over there. We've got to recognize that we have the same problems. That the police department that goes around the town telling people don't sit on the sidewalk, the police officer is someone that everyone in town is afraid of. And I don't think you're really being too candid when you see that siren in the back of your car, behind you in a police car as you're riding on the street. You feel scared. Why should you feel scared if that's your police department? Because you know that even if you are not doing something wrong, you're confronting a form of naked power that really is unchecked in our town and in many other towns throughout the country. We had hoped that the Police Review Board, the Citizens Police Review Board, which meets the second Monday of every month, for those of you who are interested, would have some power on this. But the City Council, in a strange move, decided that it didn't care about the issue and allowed the appointment of a person who, at the very least, is a complete question mark. Currently, the Citizens Police Review Board is deadlocked 3-3. Three people want to make some changes where the police department would be more accountable, and the other three people, headed by a woman named Lisa Rose, the old guard, part of the old city council, want to keep things the way they were, essentially, leaving things in Police Chief Steve Belcher's pocket. And that's pretty much the way it is. And yet the city council, which originally had seemed to have some stirrings of freedom and some concerns about this issue, has now seemingly abandoned this particular interest. It came upon the seventh member, and that the key person to appoint to that body, and it appointed an individual named Dan Alper. I talked to Dan last week for about an hour and 15 minutes. Not a bad guy, you know. I don't think he's some sort of closet fascist. I don't have anything like that to say about him. But to stand up to the police department in this town or any other town, you have to be more than just an easygoing kind of person. You even have to be more than a card-carrying American Civil Liberties Union member, because, for example, in our town, the ACLU is not worth diddly squat. The ACLU has never stood up for homeless people. The ACLU has never stood up against police abuse in any meaningful or consistent way. The ACLU, the last thing the ACLU did that I remember in our town was it spoke against the youth curfew back in 1997, Bob Tarrant of the ACLU. And that was, you know, that was good, you know, but there was no action taken to try to fight for the rights of young people in our streets, not to be searched and harassed and with files gathered on them for stopping for these minimal offenses like jaywalking. You have all the trappings of a police state going on. And, of course, until it affects you, you're not aware of it. It's sort of something that is just right outside, it's kind of outside your ken. You don't really know that it's happening. But there are some people who are sort of feisty about this whole situation and are fighting back. And I've been talking about the Homeless Issues Task Force. We're going to hear some quotes from them in a minute. We're going to hear a little bit about how some folks are talking about what can we do to start with the folks at the bottom and make sure that they aren't getting the shit kicked out of them all the time. Let's hear a few more interviews and see what folks think about the situation here in Santa Cruz and even up in Scotts Valley.
Thompson, Triple C, Cubs Comics and Collectibles.
And you are a man outspoken in your views. Have you had any problems with the Scotts Valley Police Department?
Scotts Valley, no, but Felton and Santa Cruz Sheriff's Department, I've been detained unlawfully and against my will for things that I had no part of in a public place before.
Can you give me an example of when and how this happened?
Well, let's see, about a year and a half ago in Felton Park in broad daylight, somebody drove by, like with drive-by shooting, or at least that's what it looked like, and I was one of the witnesses of this, and there was lots of little families and children running around, and for some reason the police felt inclined to detain me and my friends for being witness to this, and apparently for being part of the cause, which was odd since none of us were in a vehicle.
I mean, they thought you were part of some sort of a, you thought your criminal element?
Apparently, and I think it's discrimination against young people, and I think we have a lot too much of it nowadays, just because you look young. I myself is 23. I look under 18, though, and I get quite a bit of harassment from security guards and police, including when I'm a paying customer of such fine stores as Safeway in Felton. We've had problems with security guards quite often coming up, and you'll be sitting there with $50 worth of groceries. You know, the bus system only runs once an hour. You have no choice but to wait, and they don't want you on their property because you look young. It's really screwed up.
When's the last time this happened?
In terms of having security guards harass me, probably about a week and a half ago.
And what happened on that occasion?
What happened on that occasion is I basically told the security guard my opinion and told him where he could go, you know, put his opinion.
What did the security guard say to you?
He threatened to call the cops, but,
you know. What did he charge you with?
He didn't charge me with anything except for loitering and taking up space in front of a business. And, again, I was clearly marked as a customer of said business.
Where were you?
Felton Fair.
Is that the big Safeway there?
Yeah, that's the big Safeway there.
Coffee roasting company is the same.
Coffee roasting company, everything. A lot of the kids get there, and there is probably some trouble elements, but, you know, I think they go off of the handle a little too much because of
the glasses. They hated the glasses.
They must have hated the glasses. They must have.
But in fact, it's legal to loiter, believe it or not, even if you aren't a paying customer.
That is true.
Provided you are not engaging in criminal behavior.
That is true.
The space is open to the public, unless you're camping on it or something like that.
Exactly.
So have you noticed that you of course run a store up there, a card store in Scotts Valley.
Scotts Valley, yeah.
Which is called?
Triple C. I'm the manager of that store.
And along with Triple C. Do you find your customers have complained to you about any problems with the Scotts Valley or Felton Police?
A lot of the kids do. They don't like being harassed about skateboarding, and they don't like being harassed about running around and just doing stuff. Personally, I think, you know, kids, the majority of them aren't that bad. A lot of them have problems. They think they're in the hood or something, which I find rather humorous. But for the most part, these kids are just, you know, they're just trying to be out and outdoors, and they get harassed for stuff that really shouldn't be illegal and isn't illegal, in fact. I think a lot of the kids are basically just trying to find a way to have a good time.
And what are the most common complaints here?
A lot of kids don't like the fact that they're told not to skateboard on the sidewalks. And, you know, a lot of them are pretty respectful of other people, unless, of course, somebody flies off the handle and starts harassing them over it.
Mm-hmm. And is there a place where it's legal to skateboard in Scotts Valley?
You know, I'm not sure, because everywhere you look, it says skateboarding not allowed, not permitted, no skates, nothing. I find it really humorous. And personally, I think the kids, if you give them a little bit more stretch, I think that you'll find that the majority of them are responsible enough to handle a little more freedom.
And how long have you been doing that? Doing your own? Are you your own work up there has been going on for how long?
I've been employed there for a year and a half now, and in that time we've expanded the store several times. I've gotten to know quite a few of the kids from the Scotts Valley Middle School. Some of the high schoolers from Felton area come up there, and for the most part, the kids that come into my store, they're usually good kids, and we don't see too many problems there because most of them, you know, they have a basic level of respect. If you give them respect and just ask them to treat your customers in your store with respect, they're usually good about returning it.
Now, is there a curfew in Scottsdale?
That I'm not sure of.
I know there's a curfew in the county, and I know there's a curfew in the city. I don't know if there's a curfew. I think there may be a curfew in Scotts Valley. If there were, I would wonder what you were doing about it.
Personally, not much at this time. However, we're making an effort at Triple C to turn it into a gaming place, something where kids can come and sit down and play a card game. I mean, I've noticed a lot of businesses, such as coffee shops as well, don't want you in their store if you're playing a game.
That's
it's shunned somehow. And I really think that's wrong. You know, I think if kids that are playing card games, it's shunned because of the fantasy artwork. A lot of the religious people don't like it. And personally, I'd like to see more kids playing cards. It's involving intelligence and whatnot, and we're trying to provide space for them at this point. And eventually, we hope to be full swing in terms of giving them a place to play and hang out.
Anything you want to say to the Free Radio audience about any of the issues we've covered, or perhaps some we haven't?
Censorship sucks. You guys out there listening to Free
Radio? Fuck censorship?
Yeah, fuck censorship. If this is Free Radio, yeah, I can say that, can't I? Mm-hmm. All right. Well, fuck censorship, and continue listening to Free Radio, because anything that celebrates the freedom of speech that we have legally in this country, then I say it's a good thing, and amen.
Hey, thank you, Jake.
No problem. Thanks, Bob.
All right.
And who says we don't talk to the merchants on this show? You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Bathrobs Pierre Robert Norris. We're kind of rolling along here at 96.3 and got about 40 minutes left. We had a couple of callers, one from the sushi master downtown, Matisse, who's listening in and hopefully keeping his eyes on the street for any abuses of human rights or untoward police behavior, or just keeping a general eye on what's going on down there. He runs a stand down there in front of New Leaf, and I like his sushi, but I don't know, with this yuppie influx, I don't know whether I would advise you to go eat there or not. It does cost more than the free meal, I can tell you that. So I don't know, is this an unpaid commercial announcement? I don't know. I'm glad when people who are even run businesses take an interest in police misconduct or keeping an ear open for Free Radio, so I encourage that. Also, I got a call from one of my regular listeners who wonders why I'm not getting back to the Homeless Issues Task Force, or Task Farce, as I've called it at different times, and been chastised for not thinking of something cleverer. Give me a few days, maybe I will. The task force met for 2 hours. I can give you kind of an update, and then we'll hear some snatches from the task force. It was my initial concern about the task force, as I've mentioned on the show, is that the main person getting paid, $10,000 being appropriated, is a man named Don Lane. Don Lane is a former mayor who was chosen kind of in a secret meeting with Dick Wilson and Catherine Byers, or let's say a closed meeting. Byers is the mayor, and Dick Wilson is the city manager. And he's the guy who essentially gets paid to $20 an hour for staffing this body, which didn't choose him. He's not homeless himself. He's not formerly homeless. In fact, he's a part of a political faction in the last election which was kind of anti-homeless. These are the people who ran the candidates that wanted to keep it illegal for people to sleep anywhere in the city at all. That is to say, not to sleep anywhere and everywhere, but even to sleep somewhere. They wanted that to be illegal. That was Don Lane running, essentially supporting that Linda Steinau. Now, I guess it might also be said that he supported other candidates who had different views, but he's got a problem record, and we were hoping that they would appoint someone who was really a homeless advocate or formerly homeless, because if they didn't, the whole task force to begin with was instead of a consolation prize. We're not going to make any real changes to guarantee that basic people have the right to say, let's say, sit down downtown or go into a park peacefully after dark, or walk along the river after dark. All these things are illegal, in case you didn't know. Or to cover up with a blanket after 11 o'clock at night. That's $54 crime. No, Mayor Byers said, we can't allow that, but instead we'll establish a little group of people to look into all these questions and talk to us about them. Well, I'm hoping that this group is going to do some fast talking and send some quick messages back to this city council that says, we don't need talk, we need action. End the sleeping ban now in certain sections of the city. And indeed, David Silva, who is a long-term activist who's really been responsible for a number of recent initiatives, including the Hate Crimes Initiative, or Hate Zone Initiative that I mentioned earlier, which seeks to declare Santa Cruz a hate-free zone. Certainly wishful thinking there, but, you know, why not? He's been interested in the Rent Control Initiative, which I think is a great way of combating homelessness, at least stopping more people from becoming homeless. David Silva himself brought to this Homeless Issues Task Force last night what I call the Sleeping Ban Repeal Junior Initiative. Last year it was the sleeping ban repeal. This year it's a sort of a more limited sleeping ban repeal, because they couldn't get the city council to even discuss the sleeping ban repeal initiative with any substance and in any length of time with any seriousness. So now this time it's a more limited initiative. It says essentially that it is legal to sleep or cover up with a blanket in non-residential, non-commercial, non-downtown industrial-type zones of the city. That's what it says. It's still illegal to camp. You can't put up a tent. You can't put up a stove. You cannot even put up a tarp against the rain. But it's legal to sleep. So most of the year, at least, you can't be arrested for sleeping on public property in certain areas of the city because there is no place for people to sleep. That's just the human rights reality of it. I mean, let's stop kidding ourselves, folks. That's just where we're at. And the hope is that, you know, that we can put in some restrooms in certain areas and people can, we can start working on regulated zones. But in the meantime, you don't make it a $54 crime, as Mayor Byers has, to sleep. And David Silva is now circulating this Sleeping Ban Junior initiative, which I think I use the junior with sort of a humorous effect, but it's a good idea. I support it, and I think that the Homeless Issues Task Force will also support it, almost to a person, although there is a couple of ringers in there, one from the Downtown Association, one from the Harvey West Association, and of course, staff member Don Lane, who did not support ending the sleeping ban last year, and what is he doing getting paid $20 an hour on a group that is primarily concerned with things like ending the sleeping ban? Well, he's a friend of the mayor's, so that's the answer, and the mayor is a friend of the sleeping ban. There's the simple answer, and the sad answer in this situation. So that was a problem I had with the homeless, have with the Homeless Issues Task Force from the get-go. But that doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of good people on this task force. What happened? Well, we know that even though Don Lane's getting $20 an hour and is sort of a, again, a sop as a consolation prize, he's appointed a formerly homeless person to be his assistant. Does that assistant get paid $20 an hour? No, she gets paid $8 an hour. Differential wage. And a woman, my co-producer, says that's true, too. I'm hoping that we can get the task force to do something about this little disparity and suggest that it's time to look for a staff person who is formerly homeless, who can do what Don Lane does, who isn't just one of the mayor's cronies, and also an opponent of civil rights activity for the homeless, or a past opponent of that. Or let's put it this way, a person who's been unwilling to stand up strongly and publicly in favor of civil rights for the homeless. Lane has done some good things, too, in his past. But more recently, he's been sort of involved with what I call the Kennedy Gang. That's Scott Kennedy, city council member whose term ended last time, who really retired under a significant cloud for his support of the Beach Flats Canfield Company giveaway, where they were going to give away a lot of land and power and prerogatives to the beach boardwalk, where they were going to realign 3rd Street and evict several 162 households is what my producer tells me. Hispanics, of course, but still they were going to, you know. And again, this kind of brings up the issue of Don Lane. Don Lane reappeared this year as a person who wanted to head a project to do the same thing again, to evict the people who were primarily at the center of the resistance to last year's beach boardwalk giveaway, giving away all this property to Charlie Canfield to expand his beach boardwalk in the hope that it would give more business to the downtown and so eventually give us some benefits, like lots of nice traffic, another 75 tons of litter, and who knows what else, but certainly not more real housing for low-income people who need it, not open space for people who want that, not campgrounds for people who need low-income campgrounds to sleep in at night, none of that. So Lane was apparently going to come forward and head the Dolphin Lee Project, which was being pushed by Andy Schifrin, Marty Wormhout, Supervisor Marty Wormhout's aide. This is one of these pork barrel projects masquerading as a low-income housing project, which would again result in the eviction of several hundred Hispanic people. And ironically, the Hispanic people who had fought to elect our current city council and to stop the Canfield Company's demolition and condemning of property so that it can just sort of develop, and evict. So I wondered, what is Lane doing on this body? So I don't like it. I'm not on that Homeless Issues Task Force, though. I don't, what have I got to say about it? I raised the issue at the meeting, but I raised it in the following way. I said, I think, we want to have a continuous staff person. We don't want to spend a lot of time arguing about this. Let's let Don Lane continue on his job, his $20 an hour job, while the poor relative, who's the woman, the formerly homeless woman, gets $8 an hour, and have him look for somebody who is homeless or formerly homeless who can do the job he does. I mean, certainly, I asked him actually some time ago what his special skills were in this regard, and he said, well, I haven't really done it before. His skills are he's got friends in high places, and he's been a political person, and he's been he's a former mayor of the town, and, you know, Becky, my producer has some things to say about this. Maybe we should have her join the jamboree. I could ask her about this. I don't want to turn this into a trash Don Lane session. I've said my piece about him, and I think what's needed is to have the Homeless Issues Task Force say its piece, because that's really what's important. The Homeless Issues Task Force should stand up and insist that homeless people and formerly homeless people and homeless advocates get, you know, at least if nothing else comes out of this whole situation, at least somebody will get housed with the salary from this job, which is, as I said, I think the whole task force is something of a diversion and an attempt to, you know, throw attention away from the reality of the situation and give the city a kind of a fig leaf to say, oh, look, we have a homeless issues task force. Yeah, we have a sleeping ban. Yeah, we have 500 to 1,500 people who are homeless every night, but we have a task force. You know, so that's what they're doing with this thing. But the task force, as I said, I think can turn this whole thing around. I don't necessarily see they will, but I'm hoping that that's always a possibility, that they can turn this whole thing around. And Linda LeMaster was made chair of this. She is a formerly homeless person. She's a mother. She's a person who is the head of housing now in Santa Cruz. She herself has been arrested for fighting for homeless rights for people here in Santa Cruz, for occupying abandoned housing or housing was going to be just demolished, and she saved it, and it now serves single families. She's got a lot of good things to recommend her. So there's a good chair. The co-chair is Ken Cole. Ken is the new head of the Homeless Services Center. The Homeless Services Center, as you know, is the sort of the ghetto to which people are consigned out there at the River Street, at Coral Street. And, you know, I'm glad there's a place for folks to go during the day, and so are the merchants. Are they glad, I'll tell you. There are lots of lockers out there for people who need them. There's a phone. There's a meal once a day, and I guess a sort of a smaller meal in the morning. And then there's this Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, which operates out of the Coral Street open-air shelter, the Coral Street complex, the Homeless Services Center, which only serves 30, count them, 30 people every night. And every night, virtually every night, people are turned away. So, I mean, there is something going on out there, and I'm glad that what's going on is going on. And Ken Cole supervises that. And I've had a pretty good impression of Ken, though there are some who haven't. And there was a rather controversial episode that happened at the very beginning of the meeting. Homeless activist Lou Rice, the only homeless person on the task force, really, actually the only homeless person on the task force, angrily resigned. He accused Ken Cole of making racist, calling him a racist and a sexist. And it was a kind of a brouhaha. And I hate to get into that kind of stuff. And I hope that Lou comes back. Lou's a very, very passionate man. Lou Rice, for those of you who don't know, is the man who fasted for several weeks. He fasted for 27 days, but he was sitting for several weeks in front of the post office demanding better services at Ken Cole's Homeless Services Center. It was then Karen Gillette's Homeless Services Center, and Ken Cole took it over. But I got to say that Lou is a man who's got a very quick temper, and there's no question about it, but he's also got a very strong dedication to justice, and I'm hoping that there could be some mediation in there, and that might work too. And there are also numerous homeless people who came to this thing, mainly because I put out a flyer about it. For some reason, I couldn't get any members of the Homeless Issues Task Force to put out flyers about it, but I was able to get some cooperation and circulated a flyer. We got some food there, got some chili donated by the Bagelry. Thank you, Bagelry. And some pastries donated by Emily's. Thank you, Emily's. And, you know, there's a little something for folks to eat. There was some interesting stuff that happened, and it was just a first meeting. People organized, and they plan to have a second meeting next Monday for all of you Homeless Issues watchers. You can come to the second meeting of the Homeless Issues Task Force at 5:30 on Monday. Where is a good question? They haven't really found a place. If it's at the same place, it'll be at what's called the ABC room of the Municipal Auditorium, which is right across from City Hall. But it's not too clear that it's going to be there, but it's definitely going to be at 5:30 on Monday. And for those of you who want to know, give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. That's the number for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and I'll try and get that information to you. This is 96.3 FM, and let's see if we can give you just a few kind of snippets of what went on in this meeting. I want to make sure I play the right tapes here. That's always a problem. I want to make sure that works. Yeah, I think this is the one. The heart of the meeting was in what's called the kind of brainstorming session, where folks went around saying what they thought the objectives of the group should be. And we actually had a couple of homeless people. They weren't, of course, members of the task force, mind you. There were no homeless people on this task force. But they were present, and they spoke. And here's some of the things that were said.
Homeless. And I was kind of like a quadruple whammy, because I was homeless twice. One time I was conserved on conservatorship, so taxpayers were paying for my well-being to make sure that I was in a safe place. And the wonderful Bob Goldstein and Steve Rizika, my coordinator, didn't do anything to help me in that situation, and I repeatedly came to them. So I was not homeless by choice. I was also pregnant while I was under conservatorship and homeless. And I got to live on $44 a week. And so I went to them many, many times, and Steve said, okay, well, I can't do anything for you, but you can look at my telephone book on my desk at Emmeline. So that was the help that I got there. And since I was under conservatorship, when I found in the phone book myself, you know, from calling information, a place for unwed homeless pregnant ladies, that was in San Jose, I went over there, and they're supposed to be a Christian organization, and I got my...